Hello, everybody. I'm Phil Margavichus, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com and follow us on LinkedIn. If you are enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching Funding MedTech on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. Funding MedTech is an interview-style podcast focused on exploring ways to fund MedTech innovation and will be released weekly on Wednesdays. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins. Building MedTech companies the right way, based on great technology, is not a one-size-fits-all endeavor. McDonald Hopkins provides customized and proactive strategies that align clients' valuable medtech technology with their business goals. This, in turn, builds those clients into successful, thriving companies. With strong experience and depth in the startup, venture capital, intellectual property, and fundraising arenas, McDonald Hopkins can be an important part of your team to help you develop the medtech business that you envision. In this episode, Ronan O'Hagan at Bechtus Therapeutics and Dwayne Mancini discuss the overlap between pharma and medtech, what a medtech company can learn from a pharma startup, the importance of communicating science in a digestible manner, building your team, fundraising strategy, and so much more.
Ronan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dwayne. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So, Ronan, let's start with an introduction into your background in the space, who you are, and then maybe take us up to, you know, currently you're the CEO at Bechtus Therapeutics. And so maybe take us up to that point, and then we'll dive into Bechtus after that.
Yeah, sure. So as you said, Dwayne, I'm the president and CEO of Bechtus Therapeutics, which is an oncology therapeutics company focused on bringing precision to immune therapies for cancer so we can really realize and unleash the potential of the immune system to bring curative therapies to patients living with cancer. So prior to Bechtus, I spent a significant amount of time at another startup company called Exilio Therapeutics, where I was the chief scientific officer. And so it really helped to build that company from its foundation, closing the first round of financing through an IPO. And over the course of 3 years there, built a really productive team. I was fortunate to find a lot of talented people. And in 3 years, we brought four programs from idea through to development candidates, two of them, now three of them into the clinic. And actually, they're showing some really interesting activity in the clinic, which I think is proving the point of what we were trying to do at Exilio, which is, from a scientific perspective, very satisfying. Prior to that, then I spent a number of years at Merck Research Labs leading the oncology discovery group. So that was broadly across the whole oncology space. And because of some of the work that I was doing there, I was fortunate enough to become co-leader of the translational oncology effort, where me on the discovery side and one of my clinical colleagues inform really strategic decisions for Merck as a company. What sort of business deals should we do? What sort of partnerships should we develop in the clinic? What kind of discovery program should we work on? So it was really using scientific information to drive business decisions, which is something that is a lesson that was sort of explained to me a long time ago. It's a great way to think about the biopharma industry as it's, you know, science-based data driving business decisions. And then prior to Merck, I spent about 10 years at another startup biotech company where I was the first scientist on board. And it came out of actually work that I was doing with a number of other people when I was at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute as a trainee there. And so, there was a point in time when I said, you know, I'm going to write an R01 grant and follow an academic pursuit. But as a brief segue, a little bit of a story at that point in time. I was in an older building at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and I had to go to this brand new building for every seminar and all of the really interesting scientific and clinical talks. And every day, as a result, I walked past the front of the Jimmy Fund Pediatric Oncology Clinic. And so what really sort of sunk in over time was the work I was doing was really important to people, to families, to parents, to kids. And Dana-Farber, obviously, there's many adult oncology patients there. And so I was exposed to patients on a day-to-day basis in places like the cafeteria or the coffee shop. And occasionally would have an opportunity to talk to those patients and realize, you know, as much as I'm really interested in, you know, the molecular biology and the cancer biology in a mouse system or in a cell, it really is important to patients. And so that sort of began to create in me a desire to think about how I could benefit patients. And along came someone who said to me, "Hey, Ronan, it would be really, you know, you probably find it really exciting if you could, you know, apply your work in a way that would bring a medicine to patients and be able to look back on that medicine having served many patients. And that would be more fun than publishing Cell Science and Nature papers." You know, as an academic, it's hard to make that transition, but it really did sink in with me. And so around that time, we took the project I was working on and a number of the sort of academic principal investigators at Harvard and MIT set up this company, and I moved over to the company really to run the science there. We built that company over 10 years through a public offering, approved drug, you know, and actually it was recently acquired by a Korean pharmaceutical company, although obviously not involved in that anymore. That's maybe 15 years ago since I left that company, which was Aveo Pharmaceutical. So that's kind of my transition, was really that realization that science can serve patients. So that was sort of that kind of brought me through that whole journey. And the goal was to figure out how can I best learn how to do that.
That's really cool. What's your educational background?
So trained as a scientist. I think of myself as a scientist by training, but a builder by nature, I guess. So I really like starting new things and getting them up and running. And so that's kind of the focus of what I try to do for the most part.
Cool. Did you get your PhD in something, master's, bachelor's?
No. So I did a bachelor's degree, went to graduate school for a variety of reasons, didn't finish the PhD. And that was one of the things that really drove the transition, that I knew I could move into industry and be really effective there. And, you know, as a result, it's sort of a way to realize what I can do scientifically without having sort of letters and numbers behind my name that indicate a certain level of training. So, yeah.
That's very really cool.
What you can deliver, I think, becomes the most important thing in industry.
Right. Yeah. No, I love your discussion about the patient's piece of it, because I think that so I have a master's in medicinal chemistry, so come from the lab as well. And that was something that is so fortunate at the time, is that at the University of Toledo, where I did my degree at, they had moved the College of Pharmacy and all the research labs to the health science campus. And we sat at the hospital, and every day at lunch, I'd go sit in the cafeteria and get lunch. And you start to see the effect of the research you're doing in the basement of the hospital, you know, really does pay off. And that's kind of where that bug for me, I caught that bug and I can't get rid of it, where, you know, the things we're working on with the startup companies that we engage with are ultimately going to be a tool in the tool belt of physicians or clinicians in general to save lives. And I just think that is like just such a cool place to sit. And so I love that you brought that up, because I think it's easy to lose sight of that in this industry. You know, like you think about, we're going to get into Bectis, but I think you were also, or you're still currently with Apricity Health as you know, in any of these startups you've ever been with, it's in a leadership role, you are constantly helping to raise money, worrying about the business, working with those investors, managing, you know, enabling the team that you've built underneath you to drive the project forward and get the product to launch and all these things. And, you know, sometimes it's easy to lose track of like what the real mission is and also like the real impact you're having on patients. So, I really love that you brought that piece up.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the mission is central, right? And patients is the core of that. That's really, you know, and so while it's defined with Bectis around precision, immunotherapies for cancer treatment, in all cases, every time, every company that I've been involved with and every situation I've been in, it's really been about a mission that is patient-centric. And that's complicated. And as you said, there's a lot of decisions that have to be made along the way. But I think if you take that mission and you under sort of support that with particular values that help you deliver on the mission, then that makes decision making a lot easier when things really get complicated.
Yeah. So, Apricity Health, that would have been the company you went to after, what was the other company?
After
Xylem?
Exilio,
Exilio Therapeutics. Yeah. So what does Apricity Health do? How did you kind of step into that role?
So Apricity Health was founded by a number of sort of luminaries in the oncology field, including Jim Allison, who won the Nobel Prize in 2018 for his work in immuno-oncology, Pam Sharma, who's a leading clinician in the immuno-oncology space, Keith Flaherty, who's the head of translational oncology research at Massachusetts General Hospital here in the Boston area, and Linda Chin, who's formerly of MD Anderson, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, is a big data whiz. And so they founded Apricity Health really with the goal of using a digital health solution combined with a staffing solution to enable oncologists outside of major academic centers to bring the best cutting-edge care as quickly as possible to patients. So 80% of patients in the US are treated outside of academic cancer centers. They're treated in community practices. And as a result, they don't necessarily have all of the sort of cutting-edge access to the kinds of things that go on around clinical trials that are sponsored with large amounts of financing behind those clinical trials. And so what that means is there's somewhat inequitable care for those patients. And so Jim and Pam and Keith and Linda really wanted to set up a platform that would enable improved equity around cancer care. And I've known all of them for a long time. And so actually the day after they came to meet with me, and I had lunch with Linda in particular and spoke with them the week following my departure from Merck. I just started at Exilio and we started talking about what they were doing there. And as part of that conversation came up the notion that, well, not only can you address, equity in cancer care, if you really want to be long-term and think about this and serve the patients in the long term, you've got to be inclusive in the research that you do. And if you do all of your research in major academic cancer centers, you focus on a subset of cancer patients and you don't access all of the diversity of cancer patients in the US, never mind the rest of the world. And so we talked about the notion that we could build a translational research platform that would access information from patients who were treated in this in across all cancer center settings, including the community practices, and access the other 80% of patients who aren't really represented in the research today. And so that was the goal when I joined. So I, built Exilio. They were building the platform, the digital health platform around Apricity. And there was a point in time when it became really obvious that, we should get together and I could start to take off from that, what we call a virtual cancer center, which is this digital health platform and staffing solution for oncology practices. And we could really take that virtual cancer center and begin to think about taking patients in there, asking them to enroll and into clinical trial studies or research studies, and following what is going on in patients who do and don't respond to the existing current therapies, and build the translational platform to understand that. The goal being then, across all cancer patients, 100% potentially could be enrolled in here across all of the diversity of what we see in the oncology community. And now, can we learn lessons from all of those? And some of those lessons are probably different to the lessons you learn in academic cancer centers because of the sort of cross sections of patients that you typically see in the different environments.
Oh, that is really cool. So what is the status of Apricity Health?
Yeah, so Pricity, we've the virtual cancer center, the digital health platform are up and running. There are multiple payers and practitioners who are part of the Pricity virtual cancer center today. We recently opened the research protocol, and so we're enrolling patients directly into the Pricity component or into the virtual cancer center where we're running translational studies. Now looking at patients directly as part of Apricity. Up to now, what we've done is based the Apricity model on collaborations with some of the academic cancer centers so we could build the translational platform in parallel to building the virtual cancer center. And today, what we're doing is we're bringing those two things together. So now we have an ongoing access to all cancer patients in the virtual cancer center across different types of practices and settings, and we can apply the translational platform we built now to understanding why those patients don't respond to existing care. And of course, the extension of that is to think about, and how do we help them to respond by adding additional care and insight?
Yeah, very cool. Okay, great. So let's dive into Bectus real quick. So you mentioned briefly, right? Precision, empowering the immune system, right? Those sorts of things. But kind of talk about Bectus. Where did the baseline research come from? Did it come out of a university, cancer center, what that is? And then maybe just talk a little bit about, you know, where you currently are and what's in store in the next year or two.
Absolutely. So, I mean, we just spoke about Apricity Health and the insights that we're gathering from a translational perspective across diverse cancer patient populations within the Apricity translational platform. So that's where the insights came from. So what we've understood as a result of, you know, many years of learning from our academic founders at Apricity, the work that I've done over the past 25 years in the biotech setting, what we've all come together to understand is the immune system is dynamic and changes. You know, if you get a cold, your immune system changes. If you don't get a cold, it changes in a different way. You know, depending on whether you get a vaccine or you get an infection, it's going to change. That's true when you give patients drugs too. When you give them a drug that tries to modulate their immune system, the immune system will respond in different ways. Some patients will respond well and they'll be cured from their cancer. Some patients will respond in a way that causes them to, you know, overcome the benefit of the drug. And those are patients who are resistant and therefore don't respond. So that's the insight that we gained at Apricity. And so some of those insights led us to this dynamic understanding or a dynamic insight into what goes on in patients treated with existing care and a dynamic view into why some patients don't respond. It turns out that based on the data that we have, that about half of patients who don't respond to existing immune therapies that affect T cells in patients, about half of those patients don't respond because a different cell population, the myeloid cells, myeloid cells normally have a really important role in suppressing the immune system. And it turns out in patients you give these current immune therapies to, they turn on this suppressive mechanism. So they turn back off the immune system. The cancer turns it back off through these myeloid cells. And so we've identified two really important things. One is a set of targets, a set of proteins that drive that resistance to existing therapy. But not just that. We've also identified a biomarker, which is a way to identify the patients that will benefit from therapies or drugs directed against each of those specific resistance mechanisms. So it's really two things. We've identified what should the therapy be, and how do you find the patient who's going to best respond to that therapy? So that sort of brings you back to the definition of precision, which is really to say, can you bring the right drug to the right patient at the right time? And that's what Bectus is focusing on doing, is now taking those insights and developing the specific drugs that will treat patients and developing the biomarkers that will find the patients who will respond to each of those drugs.
Yeah, very cool. I think the other piece of this that just is exciting with any kind of precision medicine, but you know, diagnostics, like anything in this space is it's really starting to empower the patient. Which is just awesome. Literally just went on a rant in the hour before your podcast, recording another podcast where I kind of ran it about patient empowerment and, you know, these kinds of things. And so anyways, I just think that's super cool. You know, one thing as you were talking that I just love to get your insight on is, you know, you were the chief scientific officer in your other companies. Now you're the CEO. But regardless, you're in the C-suite. And so there's a couple things that kind of come to mind that I'd love to get your feedback on. One of those is communicating the science to other stakeholders. It doesn't just have to be investors. It could be physicians. It could be, you know, a team member that's going to join, anybody, but communicating science is a skill. That is a real skill set. And so I'd love to get your feedback on, how you look at it. Are there tips you can give other entrepreneurs out there? How do you kind of tackle that?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the first thing I remember about in communication is you have to know who the audience is, and different audiences need different information. If I'm communicating science to, you know, a high performing academic science audience, that's a very different discussion to if I'm talking to, you know, my parents who are not scientists about it, or to the general public, you know. And so, in fact, what's been really interesting lesson for me recently is I've spent most of the time prior to Bectus, I spent raising money and, you know, $500 million over different enterprises in fundraising, but it was all through predominantly venture capital related money. And so, of course, in the venture world, in biotech, many of the people you're talking to are well-trained, highly educated scientists. And so you're able to have a conversation that is, can get into some of the details and nuances, and you can use some of the, you know, the words that are, you know, invisible to other people, that are difficult to understand. Some of the jargon is okay in that context. With Bectus, we haven't focused on raising money through venture up to now. We focused on raising money through family offices and high net worth individuals at the beginning. We're starting to pivot now this year to venture because we're going to raise significantly more money as we move into the clinic with the programs. And I'll come back to the status of those later. But so what's really been helpful for me is understanding who the audience is and ensuring to communicate in a way that communicates understanding, right? You're not communicating information, you're communicating understanding. You want to make sure people understand that, not to just give them as much information as you can. It's not about me sounding smart, it's about making sure that you understand what I'm trying to say. And, you know, and then you can allow the audience to drive you into more and more detail if they want to, or bring you in the direction that they want to go. I think that's probably the most important thing that I would say, is know who the audience is. And let them steer you in the direction that is comfortable and helpful for them.
Yeah, that's awesome. The other one that came up was, so as you're fundraising, like you said, you're talking to family offices, you're talking to high net worth individuals, VCs, you know, the amounts you raise are different from a med tech to a biotech, but the strategy is still the same. And this is a challenge that I see for almost all technical founders, or more scientifically based founders, which is in the fundraise, or when you're pitching someone, how do you balance the fact that you probably really want to talk about how cool the science is versus the business model of, you know, no investor is going to write a check into your company just because you have cool tech. They're going to cut a check because they see the possibility that you are going to return 10x their money, 100x their money, 5x their money, whatever it is. You have to balance it with, this is really cool tech versus this is how you're going to make your money, right? This is how you're going to get your money back. So yep. Kind of walk me through that. And are you self-conscious of that? I mean, yeah, talk about that.
I think, you know, one of the reasons why I felt comfortable taking on a CEO role was I have gotten to a point where I think the two things are the same, right? Because what you're doing with the science is you're trying to reach certain milestones or objectives that are considered to be value inflection points for the company. And what you're trying to, from a scientific standpoint, you reach increased confidence that you're going to be successful. That's the scientific value inflection point. But those same value inflection points are the financial value inflection points, because at least in biotech, what you're really doing is de-risking the idea. You know, it's 5 to 10 years before you're going to bring a drug to market, depending, and 5 would be pretty aggressive and pretty ambitious. And so what you're trying to do in that entire time is reduce the risk that you're not going to be successful, increase the likelihood you will be successful. And as you make those sort of changes in risk profile, you increase the value. So I think those two things go together. And that was one of the things that, I mean, in fact, the way I talk about Bectus right away is to say, look, there are two advantages of what we're doing in Bectus with precision-based approaches. One is we can, in a very capital-efficient way, very quickly ask the key questions and demonstrate we have a drug that works, we have a biomarker that can find the patients, and we can show clinical proof of concept. So we can show the drug will work in the biomarker positive patients that it's supposed to work in, and it's safe when it does that. That's the scientific and clinical story. But that can be done capital efficiently, which means that it can be done with minimal dilution for investors. And so you can talk about the scientific speed and efficiency and the increased probability of success as decreased risk, reduced spend, and increased capital efficiency on the business side. And to me, those things have to go hand in hand, and you have to think about them both. Very early in my career, it used to drive me kind of crazy that the leadership in my first company at Aveo, who had lots of experience, they kept talking about value inflection points. I'm like, yeah, but isn't it about the patients and about the science? And what I've realized in the last 20 or so years is, yes, it is. That's the mission. But you have a lot of stakeholders, as you raised at the very beginning, Duane. You have to help them all understand from the language and the perspective that they have how they also benefit from achieving the mission, right? And I think that, to me, that's really the key when it comes to communication, is saying, okay, there's multiple stakeholders. How do they get something out of serving the bigger mission? Because those stakeholders often have their own stakeholders as well. When you think about, investment groups, when you think about scientists who have, or clinicians who have their own career goals. We all have, our own things that we want to do as well. And so you want to align the stakeholders' goals and their mission with the company's mission. And if you can do that, then you can serve everybody all at once. And that sort of alignment, if you can achieve that, I mean, that's really, really powerful when you can get that.
Yeah, that sure is. Working with so many startups, we at any given time, Project MedTech is actively engaged in 40, and that number is certainly creeping up to 50 now at this point. And the ones that are kind of humming along, kind of have that. They've done that well, and it's hard to kind of put your finger on like how that comes together. I think there's a lot of factors with that. It's not as easy as it sounds, but I think you're totally right. You've already raised some money. You're kind of heading out to raise more. What will that tranche of money that you're going to raise, what milestones would you get to with that?
So the goal really is to raise a Series A single priced round and to use that money to bring the lead program to clinical proof of concept, which is, the most important, in my opinion, the most important value inflection point in the biotech industry. It means your drug works. It works in the patients you think it should work in, and it does so safely. And so now you know that what you're really going to do is expand into registering that drug for commercial use. And I think the key thing with Bectus is because it's a precision-based approach, it's not, oh, it works in some patients, and we hope we can find more patients like that. Our first clinical proof of concept study will be designed or is being designed to address the patients we think will most likely respond the best to the drug. And so showing that means we now know we can go find those patients again and again and again. And it really increases the confidence we have in moving beyond that clinical proof of concept into registrational studies and achieving that sort of commercial, filing and approval with the FDA. So I think that's the goal with this next round. And, again, that's why I say we want to get to the most important clinical confidence standpoint. But from a business standpoint, we want to do that with a single round of financing. So the investors who come in this round are not going to undergo multiple rounds of dilution to get to the next step. The goal is increase the probability of success using a precision-based approach with antibodies which is the drug modality we're using, which have a best-in-class preclinical profile. We know how to find the patients with this biomarker approach that we have. So we think there's a really high probability of success there. So reducing the risk and reducing the dilution, meaning that the upside potential for those investors is going to be really high as well.
Yeah,
What we do after that, that will be a decision of those people who invest and become part of the board, whether we want to continue to do that ourselves or whether we want to partner. I have my own opinions about how best to do that in the overall biopharma ecosystem, but that'll be a decision that ultimately those investors will be part of the discussion about.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad the way you frame that the way you did, because I think that, you know, investors and understanding the risk investors take is really important. And I think the more you understand that as an entrepreneur, the more they appreciate it, the more effective a relationship you'll have. But to your point, I think you'll probably find more success because you're raising with them in mind as well. So I love that you brought that up. The one thing you brought up that is, it hasn't come up. It's come up on the podcast before, but it hasn't come up in this way before. That's made me kind of think about it this way. And that's probably because we just haven't had a ton of pharmaceutical entrepreneurs on, right? Like, we're usually in the medical device space, but I'm starting to realize there's a lot of good overlap here. And so one of these things is, you brought up clinical proof of concept. And in the pharma industry, almost all drugs, especially any new drug, requires clinical data to achieve, you know, to get through the FDA. The issue on the device side is there's the industry is almost duped by the FDA, because in a lot of scenarios, you don't need clinical data to get a device to market, right? There's a 510K path that makes up like 80 or 90% of medical devices submissions on a given year. And a lot of them, there are some, but a lot of them don't require clinical data. And so we find ourselves having to educate entrepreneurs on the fact that clinical data is really a big deal, because clinical data shows that you're, you know, that proof of concept, you're clinically effective. It's a really interesting dynamic. It's one of the things, like, you know, if we had to make a list of 10 things I'd tell any startup, it's just because the FDA says you don't need clinical data doesn't mean you don't need clinical data. And unfortunately, I think there's this, it's almost devalued the 510K clearance process in terms of, like, you're talking about value inflection points. Regulatory approval is still there. It doesn't mean as much, though. Like, I could easily make an argument to you that says, great, you got a 510K clearance. Does anybody use it? Well, no, but we're going to get into hospitals. Well, what are the hospitals asking for you to get in there? Oh, they want to seek, like, clinical data. So see, like, even if you get 510K clearance, it's almost like it's a trick. Like, that doesn't mean revenue is the next step. There might be a whole thing. There might be another year of clinical data collection before you can even generate revenue. And so it's just really interesting. I think the pharma industry is like, the FDA almost makes it so clear cut because they require clinical data for everything. But on the device side, it's a little muddy, in my opinion. And we have to, we spend a lot of time talking about, hey, I know it's early. I know you see 510K clearance, then you see you're going to sell your product. Really focus in on achieving clinical data, or at least some regional market release where people are using it, figuring it out. And I think having a realistic timeline is important there, because it is going to take longer than you think to achieve revenue. You might get 510K clearance, get it in a physician's hand, and all of a sudden you get a ton of feedback, and now you got to iterate, and you're doing like a special 510K clearance. So there's just a lot there. I think it is, like, my scientific mind goes, the pharma is so black and white because it is so regulated until you've proven that, and device is gray. And I think that is a struggle for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, when you think about therapeutic development, you need data even before you can go into a patient to convince physicians to use your drug in a patient. Like, you might get your investigational new drug application might be approved and you're free to go in to do clinical trials, but you still have to convince clinicians to use your drug in clinical trials, which means you need data that says, actually, yes, it's safe. Because really the FDA is saying, is it safe to put into people? Yes, it is. Okay, now you can run a clinical trial because it'll do no harm, right? But clinicians aren't going to use it unless you can say, well, not only will it not harm the patient, it actually has a chance to benefit the patient, right? And so you have to really show that even to run those first clinical trials, I think. And so maybe that's a little bit of an analogy, but it certainly is, in my experience, really very clear that you have to accumulate all of this data how much data and how much confidence you can get out of that data can be impacted by whether you're precise with your therapy or you're, you know, or you're general with an all comers with your therapy and so on. So I think there are differences in that regard, but you definitely need to have very clear support from all of those clinical studies.
Yeah. So last thing I want to pick your brain on. So you're gearing up for your Series A. You know, right now you're it's a solo team, right? And so you're strategizing and you're doing. Eventually, once you raise the Series A, you know, you're going to start building out your team and kind of make a transition into, hey, I'm not doing all of it. I've got to, you know, throw that to some other folks and let them own those things. And so walk me through, because you've obviously done this with the other companies as well. How do you kind of step from being that, you know, having to do everything to getting people to buy in and then letting them own certain tasks and you kind of keeping the train going on the same direction here? Because that's a tough transition.
Yeah, I mean, for Becta specifically, you know, one of the things that I'm very aware of is, you know, we want to raise the money and we need to go fast as soon as that we have that money in. There's a lot to do. I'm very confident in the data that we have and what we're going to be able to do with these therapies. You have to test it in patients to see if that confidence will bear out. But I think we've got a really good path forward. So one of the things I've started to do already is through the consultants that I'm working who are sort of filling those functions. A number of those people are really interested in joining Bectus when we raise the money. So one of the pieces of advice I got from a good friend of mine who's in the venture world was to say, can you put together, you know, effectively your shadow leadership team? Who would come on board? And can you get commitments from some of those people to join you when you raise the money or contingent upon you raising the money? And so that's actually one of the things I've been doing in the meantime is building a team of people who have flexibility and can jump on board at Bectus when we raise that money. So we'll close the A and the next day, you know, we can put in place, you know, the employment agreements and have these people on board. So that's one of the key things I think means that we're going to be able to transition very quickly. They're serving as consultants in various forms today, but they're going to come internally, at least some of them, and assuming circumstances don't change. So that's one really important piece. The other piece of, as you said, is transitioning to other people. You know, and I think one of the things that I learned really, really early in my biotech experience at AVEO, I was the first scientist. I had no industry experience. We didn't have any senior management. So there was me as a scientist, a couple of other scientists who joined me, none of whom really had much industry experience, an operations person, and a finance person. So I really had to figure out how am I going to get the first sort of department or the first function up and running, which was to sort of, you know, do some screening to find what things we should make drugs against. And then the next piece was, okay, we've done some screening. How do we do some validation that those things are right? And how do we do, as you would be familiar with, Duane, how do we do some chemistry to make a molecule against those? And when we get the molecules, how do we do some studies in cells and in animals to show that the molecules work? So I said some familiarity with all of those things. I learned how to do all of those, but I had to, in each case, build the capability to get it off the ground and overcome inertia. And then we went and hired somebody who knew what they were doing. And so I think one of the things that that taught me really early on was it's okay to get it up and running, but the key thing after you get it up and running is to find somebody who's an expert, right? And then allow them to run the whole function because they know what they're really doing. They're going to make it efficient. They're going to be much better at delivering at the quality level and the scale that one needs to for each of those functions. So that was my early learning at AVEO. And I think to a large extent, I've applied that since then in building teams is to say, look, I'm going to do whatever I need to do, but I need to find these people. And if I think if you map it out early, you can say, here's what the organization will need to look like. And before I even bring people in, I'm starting to say, here are the things that I want these other people to take over, right? I mean, an obvious one is, you know, you bring in somebody to run your finance department and they're going to take over the finances. I'm an R&D person by background. I spent a lot of time over the last number of years really learning finance and doing finance courses and understanding how the venture world works because I knew I was going to be doing this. But that's still not my domain expertise, so I need to find that person. That's an easy one to delegate, you know, and say, look, you run that. And now I'm just, I know just enough either to be dangerous, or the other way to put it is I know enough to ask questions and sort of say, well, in the context of our overall strategy, which is what my role is, are we delivering on this? Do we have the finances to do that? What happens if we make this decision instead of that? How does the research and development coordinate with finances? And so I've been lucky in leadership teams in the past also to interact, you know, as the discovery scientist, you always work with clinical people and you think about that sort of synergy. But I've been really fortunate to work with great people in organizations like the finance groups, human resources, business development, business groups, and commercial, et cetera, and found that, you know, all of those people work. If you can find a really good way to have a conversation about how do we build the business together, I want to spend more money on research, but what's the implication on the finances of the company? And now we can have a conversation that really brings all of those things up transparently. So to me, I think that experience early on of doing things and then having to give them to other people, I don't have a proprietary sense about anything that I do. If I can find someone who's better at it than me, I'm going to let them run it. And now I just know enough to ask questions. And the other thing that I think I recognize in all of this is it's really about bringing that team together to debate and discuss so that you can make the best decisions for the business, not for your department, not for your project, but for the business as a whole. And sometimes those, you know, as the scientist, sometimes I had to say, I can't do this because we need to do something else for the finance or, you know, or for the business. And I think those are important decisions that one makes. And so for me, those are the key things. Get the best people who know more than you do. And then work on ensuring that everybody's aligned on that mission and going to debate their point of view and understands that in the end, we're making a decision that delivers best for the business and the mission, not for individual departments and pieces. I think those are key things.
That's awesome. I think that is also a great way to kind of wrap up our discussion here as well. But before you go, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on? Is there any, in terms of, you know, getting more information, Bechtis Pharmaceuticals website, we can include that in the show notes.
Yep.
Is that in there? Okay, perfect. Yep. But yeah, is there anything else you wanted to cover that you were like, hey, this is our another major update or anything like that?
I mean, I think the key thing from where we are with Bechtis is, you know, we've raised some money. We've taken a year and developed two programs to clinical development candidate status at a record-breaking capital efficiency rate from my perspective. We've done that really cheaply. It helps to only have one full-time headcount and do it through consultants. And they're all consultants that I've worked with before. So I, you know, it's very easy to work with them. You know, and we've positioned the company in a way with a lead program that's now in manufacturing. And we've got a biomarker assay. And I think that precision-based approach is going to serve us really well as we move into the clinic and let us ask the key questions. And then the only other thing I would say is, you know, the other piece in all of this that I touched on from an apricity and a values and part of the larger mission here is that notion of equity in cancer care and inclusivity in research. And that's one of the things I think we can deliver on with Bechtis is because we have a precision-based approach, it means that we can ask the question about across a diverse cancer patient population about who's going to respond to these therapies. I can make some predictions based on the existing research data that there's probably over 200,000 patients a year in the US who are going to respond to our lead program. But that's based on data from major academic cancer centers, 20% of the cancer patient population. There's bound to be a set of patients in that other 80% who are probably going to benefit from these therapies as well. And one of our goals is really to use precision as a way to bring inclusivity into clinical trials, inclusivity and take that inclusivity in research there as well. So that's another piece. You know, the return on mission component of what we're trying to do with Bechtis, we want to couple that to the return on investment. And that's really thinking about who are the stakeholders. Stakeholders are investors. So that's your return on investment, of course. But the other stakeholders are the patients you're trying to deliver for. And that's a mission. So we need to return on that mission for the patients as well. So that would be the last really key thing I want to talk about is sort of return on investment and return on mission and making sure everybody gets what they're looking for out of what we're doing.
Love it. Ronan, I really appreciate your time. Hang on for 1 minute. We'll chat offline, but thanks so much for doing the podcast.
Great. Thanks, Dwayne. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you need anything from us, you can contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. And for more information on Project MedTech, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.